Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Bulldozed, Scott Morrison's Fall and Anthony Albanese's Rise by Nikki Sava. Narrated by Corinne Davies. Chapter 1. Victory and Damnation. Peter Dutton and Josh Frydenberg knew, months out from the election, that they were headed for disaster under Scott Morrison. They knew, as long as a year before, that if the election became a referendum on Morrison, they would lose. By the end of 2021, they knew, along with almost every other member of the coalition, including the most prominent members of Morrison's Praetorian Guard, that he was badly damaged, probably beyond repair. But Dutton had already torn down one Liberal Prime Minister, so he wasn't about to tear down another. And Frydenberg was never going to challenge a sitting Prime Minister. Dutton and Frydenberg were immobilised, prisoners of their history and their personalities, hostage to Morrison's misplaced conviction that he could destroy Anthony Albanese as systematically as he had demolished Bill Shorten in 2019 in what he declared a miracle win. They remained locked in a deathly embrace. Months after the election, they discovered the depths of his deception. There was a flurry of retrospective braggadocio, firing speculation that if his colleagues had known back then that he had secretly sworn himself in to five additional cabinet portfolios, four of them without the knowledge or consent of those who already held them, the rebellion would have been ignited, he would have been deposed, and Frydenberg installed. Maybe. If Morrison had refused to revoke his secret commissions, it is possible. More likely not. Much would have depended on how colleagues found out about them and when. The consensus from post-trauma discussions is that cabinet ministers would have forced him to retreat and a broken party would have limped to the election, in much the same way as it eventually did. The what-ifs are as tantalising as they are largely irrelevant. All the people who mattered, including those closest to him, already knew everything they needed to know about him, even without knowing about his clandestine acquisition of ministries. They knew he was secretive and that he lied, that he was stubborn, that he bullied people, that even if he sought advice, he seldom took it, and that he had little interest in policy. They knew that Morrison was a deeply flawed personality, a duplicitous, damaged leader with limited horizons and appalling judgment, even they were not certain they could trust, who rarely understood what Australians expected of a Prime Minister. He ignored advice from almost every quarter to go to an early election, then grew paranoid that the Dutton and Frydenberg camps were plotting a coup. Even though they could see the ship heading straight for the iceberg, they did not mutiny. Instead, they waited on deck without life jackets, without lifeboats, for their captain to ram it. Morrison used, played, and deceived them, as he had so many others, in ways that were both obvious and beyond even their imaginings. He left them with a pile of rubble, feeling wounded and betrayed. Those who stood up to him ran the risk of being frozen out. He was petty and vindictive. Few dared challenge him, worried that if they did, they would bring the show down. That reluctance ruined them and left the Liberal Party in its sorriest state since it was founded by Robert Menzies in 1944. Morrison's secret takeover of ministries showed a contempt of Parliament, of conventions, and of his ministers, including those he called his best friends, like Josh Frydenberg and Stuart Robert. They took it very personally. After the revelations, His former colleagues spat out all the M words. Messianic, megalomaniacal, and plain mad. Dutton's shadow cabinet decided that Australians would care more about the cost of living, so muted its criticisms. They didn't want to rake over the past. They didn't want to provoke him into forcing a by-election for his seat, which they feared they would lose. So they continued the protection racket, compounding the damage to their reputations and the party's standing. Perversely, they accused the government of playing politics instead of focusing on more important things, such as the economy. As if fundamentally undermining the proper functioning of responsible government, as the Solicitor General, Stephen Donoghue, put it, was of little consequence. Morrison's actions were profoundly wrong on every level. They should have cut him loose immediately. Instead, they showed they had learned nothing from their defeat. There was only one senior-serving Liberal who had the guts to say publicly, immediately, that he should quit Parliament. Karen Andrews. She was right. He was a constant reminder of everything that had gone wrong with the Liberal Party. After he found out that the Prime Minister had secretly acquired Treasury, Frydenberg, who had been loyal beyond measure to Morrison, was furious. When they eventually spoke, he said to Morrison, "You wouldn't do it again if you had your time over." Incredibly, Morrison replied, "Yes, I would." The longer Morrison stayed in Parliament, the lower down he would drag them, and the harder and longer would be the rebuilding process. He stayed, crumpled in his seat on the backbench next to Alex Hawke, glowering at the man who had replaced him. His near neighbours could hear him muttering, bitter and resentful that he had been beaten by someone he regarded as so inadequate. Morrison had always underestimated Albanese, who was both resilient and street smart. When Morrison tried to taunt him or intimidate him during terse off-mic exchanges in Parliament, Albanese, a product of New South Wales Labour when it really was a political killing machine, would brush him off, saying, "I have fought people a lot tougher than you, mate." Albanese constructed Labour's winning strategy, stuck by it in the face of external criticism and internal doubts, faltered at a critical time, then recovered to secure majority government, something that only three other Labour leaders had done before him since the Second World War. Albanese knew, as surely as Dutton and Frydenberg did, that keeping the focus on Morrison would deliver victory. There were many factors that contributed to the coalition's defeat. The desertion of women, the desertion of Chinese Australians, a yearning for tougher action on climate change, the desire to restore integrity and trust in institutions, and lingering frustrations over COVID. Hanging over all of it like a dark mist was Morrison. There was no escape from him. Not for one moment. There was not a single cut-through policy he offered to leaven the images or lift the vote. When Albanese contracted COVID during the campaign, after an awful first week rescued by his win in the first debate, it gave members of his shadow ministry, including Penny Wong, Jason Clare, Katie Gallagher, and Jim Chalmers, the opportunity to shine. They provided a stark contrast to Morrison's one-man show, which was causing internal friction, even before colleagues knew the extent of his deceit. Albanese's absence ensured that Morrison stayed in full focus, front and centre, not even able to air punch his chief opponent, literally fighting shadows, desperately trying to explain the disastrous news that the Solomon Islands had signed a security pact with China, which dissolved his credentials on national security, one of the three pillars he had constructed to secure his re-election. The second being the economy, and the third, a culture war grounded in an appeal to the religious right. Skyrocketing inflation, steep increases in the cost of living, a rise in interest rates, low wages, and $1 trillion of debt, now Labour's dismal inheritance, ate away at Morrison's reputation as an economic manager. Religion was central to Morrison's life. Colleagues believed it drove him, made him immovable, more resistant to logical explanations. He surrounded himself with people who thought like him, ministers, friends, staff, who took part in regular prayer sessions in his office and at the lodge. He used religion in ways that no Australian leader had before in an effort to harvest votes. He flaunted it. It was there more subtly in 2019. In 2022, it was blatant and divisive as he sought to push through the religious discrimination bill that failed to protect vulnerable children. Morrison's response to the defeat of his bill at the hands of his own MPs was typically self-pitying and revealing. His words then, along with a post-election sermon in Perth, help explain his view of life and politics, and why nothing that went wrong was ever his fault. "I have been mocked every day because of my faith, because I am a Pentecostal," Morrison was heard to say to colleagues after the vote on the bill. "I have surrendered this battle to God now. I have said, over to you." Weeks later, hoping to mobilise the religious right, he deliberately chose a candidate fated to exploit the sensitive issue of transgender women during the heat of an election campaign. Occasionally, during meetings with cabinet ministers, he would recite passages from the Bible he had read that morning that had inspired him. He laid hands on colleagues in prayer. A few found it comforting. A few thought it was weird. He would lecture them on hubris, then neglect to heed his own advice. In early June 2020, after his standing had been restored as a result of his early handling of COVID, he reminded his leadership group of the fate of Winston Churchill, who had led Britain to victory in the Second World War, then lost the election. "We can't take anything for granted," he told them. Then he gave people no reason at all to vote for him again. In 2022, Morrison thought he could win by frightening people out of voting for Albanese, just as he had frightened them into choosing him over Shorten in 2019. The second time around, there was no Shorten, nor Shorten's promise of $400 billion in new taxes. He had nothing to offer other than himself, and he had become a massive drag on the vote in Liberal strongholds. Nor was it obvious this time that he had God on his side. One former cabinet minister who had known Morrison for many years told me that Morrison had this thing about God wants this, or God has chosen me to be prime minister. The overflow from 2019 was that he and others around him believed their own bullshit. His friends despaired that he kept repeating his mistakes and that he had misread the reasons for the 2019 victory. They complained that he refused to take advice and that he treated them badly. "He got addicted to executive authority," Alex Hawke said. Another close colleague questioned Morrison's loyalty. "He always took his friends for granted, and he wanted his enemies to love him," he said. "Often, he would screw his friends." Morrison had begun his parliamentary career in 2007 after a dirty pre-selection. His tenure as Prime Minister was conceived in deception, marked by disasters and ended in disgrace. A few of Morrison's colleagues, male and female, said they never had a problem with him. Others, male and female, said he was a bully or plain belligerent. Describing himself as a bit of a bulldozer, he offered a week out from polling day to change, to be a better person and a better prime minister, if only people would give him another chance. It sounded like a come-to-Jesus moment, a plea from a condemned man for a reprieve at 5 minutes to midnight. After he lost, he quoted Barnaby Joyce, of all people, to say that sometimes people just wanted to change the curtains, as if voting him out had an air of whimsy about it. No, voters bulldozed the House with him inside it, sending tremors across the political landscape. In wondrous, clever ways, voters did whatever they had to do to be rid of him, electing greater numbers than ever before of Greens and Independents, seeing that the Liberal Party couldn't bring itself to remove him for them. They wanted the Liberals to change or die. They put Labor on notice to perform or else. Only weeks after the election, the Greens and the Teals, confident that this was just the beginning, were planning which seats to target next. Morrison did not instigate the drift away from major parties, but he indisputably accelerated it, then carried on as if it didn't matter, ignoring the damage he was inflicting on his vulnerable colleagues. In the end, voters worked him out. They grew sick and tired of his weaving, wedging, dodging, fibbing, and fudging. They despaired at his absence at critical times, his refusal to accept responsibility for his mistakes, his stubbornness, and his slowness to respond. Morrison would lie, get caught out, and then he would deny that he had lied, pretending it never happened, rarely, if ever, apologizing for it, seemingly incapable of admitting it, even to himself. It was stunning that the rebuttal of his lies with audiovisual proof did nothing to stem their number or frequency. Boris Johnson without the hair or the humour. His obsession with secrecy, his insistence on absolute control, his aversion to transparency, his readiness to corrupt proper processes, and the complacency of sections of the media about his behaviour were fully exposed after publication of a book designed to cast him as the country's saviour during a pandemic, but which unintentionally revealed him as a power-hungry control freak who lacked confidence in his own colleagues. He amassed unprecedented powers while simultaneously avoiding responsibility and accountability. The rich, delicious irony of the events triggered by that book plagued, most of which came directly from Morrison, where his early usurpation of two portfolios was presented as an elegant solution. Would have been hilarious if it were not so serious. We should be grateful that he believed it was such an act of genius that he needed to share it with the two authors at the time, so that after publication it would embellish a legacy he claimed he never wanted. He swore himself in first as Health Minister on the 14th of March 2020, with the knowledge and consent of the Minister, Greg Hunt, as a safeguard because the powers vested in Hunt under the Biosecurity Act were so immense. Then he took over finance on the 30th of March 2020, the portfolios of industry, science, energy and resources on the 15th of April 2021, and home affairs and treasury on the 6th of May 2021, all without telling the responsible ministers. He acquired resources specifically to override the minister, who was preparing to make a decision that Morrison judged would cut across his political interests. under pressure from MPs, including his friend Lucy Wicks in Robertson and Inner Urban Liberals, Morrison was determined to block the PEP 11 project to drill for gas off the New South Wales coast. The other resources minister, Keith Pitt, was planning to approve the project, using the authority vested in him alone to do it. Or so he thought. Pitt made it clear to Morrison all the way through of his intention to endorse the April 2020 recommendation of the National Offshore Petroleum Titles Administrator to extend the exploration license. Morrison's office asked Pitt in February 2021 to delay his decision, to give the Prime Minister more time to resolve it with his colleagues. Pitt agreed. Soon after, he had a heated argument with Yaron Finkelstein, Morrison's chief political adviser, after Morrison was asked in Tomago on the 4th of March if he supported the extension of the licence, and twice said no. Pitt was furious that Morrison had publicly stated his position, which contradicted his own as the responsible minister. Morrison and Pitt discussed it again on the phone on the 27th of March, when Pitt again made it clear that he planned to approve the project. Pitt and Morrison then met in Canberra in early June. The Nationals leader, Michael McCormack, attended that meeting. Pitt was immovable, making it clear he would grant the extension. Pitt, Morrison, and their staff met again a few days later, without McCormack. Pitt thinks this was around mid-June. He was not sure of the exact date, but it was before McCormack's ousting by Joyce on the 21st of June. It was at this meeting that Morrison told Pitt he had sworn himself in as Resources Minister and that he would decide against the extension if Pitt wasn't prepared to do so. Pitt's first thought was, WTF? A thought shared later by millions when it became public. Pitt asked that all staff, his and Morrison's, including Finkelstein, clear out so he could be alone with the Prime Minister. I've never had a screaming match with the guy, Pitt said later. Pitt asked Morrison how he could swear himself in to another minister's portfolio, and if that was even constitutional. Morrison told him he had advice that it was. Pitt said he would check it out for himself. Pitt went back to his office. He read the section in the House of Representatives practice, the day-to-day Bible for MPs, on the operations of Parliament and the Executive. He could not find any precedent for what Morrison had done. He was left with few choices. He could offer his resignation. Morrison could ask for his resignation. Or Morrison could tell McCormack to sack him. Or Morrison could take it to Cabinet, roll Pitt there, and Pitt could either resign or live with having to announce the rejection of the permit. Later, Morrison could offer no satisfactory explanation to Pitt why he did not do that. To this day, Pitt does not understand why he didn't. Pitt told me he seriously considered resigning. He also discussed with his staff the option of unilaterally releasing a statement approving PEP 11 without telling anybody in advance, including Morrison, which he would have been entitled to do. Two senior Morrison staff suggested to me later that Pitt was grateful he had been relieved of the responsibility for the decision. Pitt was momentarily lost for words when this was put to him. The Prime Minister's office had asked Pitt's office if he wanted to put his name on Morrison's 16th of December press release announcing the rejection. Hell no, Pitt told his staff. He never endorsed the decision. He never once said he supported it. Pitt remembered seeking advice from Arthur Sinodinos when he was an assistant minister to Greg Hunt, Pitt says Hunt was pressing him to agree to something he opposed. Top of mind for Pitt during his dealings with Morrison was Synodinius's words. You never sign a brief you haven't read. You never sign a brief you don't understand. You never sign a brief you don't agree with. Within 24 hours of his meeting with Morrison, Pitt went to McCormack's office to tell him what Morrison had done and to seek his support. Pitt did not get it. He suspected that McCormack already knew what had happened by the time he told him about Morrison being sworn into his portfolio, because McCormack didn't act surprised. This is ridiculous. You are the leader of the Nationals, Pitt says he told him. Either it's our portfolio or it isn't. This is a breach of the coalition agreement. McCormack replied, he is the Prime Minister. Again, Pitt told McCormack, you are the leader of the Nationals. McCormack told me later that he did not already know. He has a different recollection of his conversation with Pitt. He said he did not believe Pitt told him explicitly that Morrison had sworn himself into the portfolio, only that Pitt told him Morrison had made himself, as Prime Minister, a signatory for that decision. McCormack says that is when he said he is the Prime Minister. McCormack also disputes that Pitt told him he was the leader of the Nationals and that it was a breach of the coalition agreement. He says he would have remembered that. McCormack says there was a lot going on at the time, not just PEP 11. However, he said he recalled Morrison telling the National Security Committee and the leadership group that he had sworn himself in as health minister and might have to take on other portfolios if necessary. Pitt stands by his version of events and his conversation with McCormack. Immediately after his meeting with McCormack, he went back to his office and briefed his then chief of staff, Gerard McManus. What he told McManus that day is the same as what he told me for this book. Barnaby Joyce coyly says he found out obliquely what Morrison had done and also succumbed. After resuming the Nationals' leadership on the 21st of June, not long after Pitt's discussion with Morrison and McCormack, Joyce also neglected to disclose it publicly because he said he wanted to keep the Nationals' extra ministry and staff entitlements. There are those who believe that Joyce was aware of what happened and that he used it, obliquely, against McCormack to roll him. Whatever, Joyce's pitch to the Nationals to remove McCormack was that he didn't stand up to Morrison. Pitt describes it as a wild time. With the pandemic still raging, he did not believe he would achieve anything by resigning or acting unilaterally, except to plunge the government into crisis. He wondered if anything else was going on inside the Liberal Party that made Morrison reluctant to take it to cabinet. In fact, there was. Morrison announced his decision to block PEP 11 after Parliament had risen, on the same day that Frydenberg released the mid-year fiscal outlook, and after a period of high anxiety for Morrison over his leadership, when he was convinced that both left and right were out to get him. Morrison's catalogue of known disasters prompted muttering, despair, fantasizing, and regular appeals for someone, or for either of the two aspirants, to do something. Nothing ever came of it. Partly, that was because Dutton and Frydenberg figured there was only one safe way to be rid of Morrison that would minimize the bloodshed and likely acts of vengeance from the most ruthless, duplicitous political player either of them had seen. And they had seen a few. They believed Morrison might have entertained stepping down if two of his best friends in the parliament, Ben Morton...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?